Podcasting Them Softly is very excited to have actor Bill Allen on our podcast today. Bill is best known for his turn as Crew Jones in the epically amazing 1980s cult film Rad, which was directed by Hal Needham. Bill has also been featured in Brothers, Felon, Breaking Bad, The Astronaut Farmer, and Born on the 4th of July. Bill just released a memoir about his experience on the making of Rad, as well as his career as an actor and what he has upcoming. Please visit Bill's website, BillAllenRad.net, to purchase his new memoir. You can also purchase an autographed copy, as well as very other cool Rad merchandise. Welcome to the show, Bill. This is incredibly exciting to have you on.
Oh, thanks, man. I'm happy to be here, Frank.
This is wild.
Yeah, nice to meet you, Bill. It was very, very exciting when we found out we'd be able to get a chance to talk to you. As I said, when we were just warming up, Rad, as I know for Frank too, Rad was one of those movies that we grew up with as kids. So it holds that special piece in your heart when you know you're growing up.
That's really great. I love that aspect of the movie that it's now a multi-generational thing, and it was so much a part of so many people's youth that now they're looking back on that time period as kind of a magical formative part in their lives, and are now rediscovering the movie and now reconnecting with me over Facebook, and it's been great.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I was so excited when I found out we were going to have you on. I told my mom because, like, of course my mom was the one that would take me to, like, the Dollar Video or whatever it was when I was little. And, you know, Rad would be in, like, the Never-Ending Story, Return of the Jedi, Ewok Adventures bundle that, I'd like, every time we'd go, like, I'd always want to get it so I could rewatch it. And my mom just started laughing, and she's like, you've got to be kidding me. I'm like, no, Mom, this is, like, the most amazing thing ever. We get to have the guy from Rad on. Because I always looked at Rad as, like, one of those quintessential 80s films, like, you know, like Vision Quest and maybe not All the Right Moves, kind of, but more so like Vision Quest, where it took something that was a sport that wasn't necessarily popular or in the mainstream then and made, like, everybody who saw it want to become a wrestler or want to get a BMX bike and do, like, flips and stuff or go dancing with the bike. I mean, it's just, it's insane. It's such a great film.
It's really kind of transcended what it set out to do, you know, and I think it's the nostalgia part of it and the novelty of BMX at the time. They really capture the innocence of that era and kind of introducing the sport to the world. So while the box office was initially disappointing, it has exceeded my wildest dreams as far as kind of finding its place in the fabric of American pop culture.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah.
And it's one of those items that, you know, we said before too, is that, like, given how much nostalgia there is for the film and given how, you know, the cult status that it's taken on, it's shocking that a distributor like Shout Factory or Olive or somebody hasn't, you know, grabbed it or, you know, put it out as a special edition DVD, Blu-ray. I know that you personally have nothing to do with the, you know, with that end of things, I'm assuming at least. Do you have any idea as to why it's taken so long to get an official release of a movie that I would imagine would sell really well?
Yeah, I'm not really privy to the producer's decisions or exactly why it is played out in such a way. I think in an interesting way it has added to the mystique of the movie because it's horrifying.
No doubt, yeah.
And so that's kind of an unintended consequence. But, you know, I'm disappointed that it hasn't made it out in an official Blu-ray capacity. I'm told it will be in the next year. We've got a 30th anniversary of the movie coming up next year, so that would be an auspicious time to release it.
Yeah, and it was just a just about to say, next year is the 30th anniversary, so maybe somebody has that in the cards. It's just, it's one of those titles that, as you said, has taken on a lore of you know, where can I find it, where can I see it, who has it. I mean, as I recall, if I'm not mistaken, the only available way to see it was on VHS or some sort of very short printed laser disc, and I don't even know if it was in widescreen or anything like that. And of course, it's made appearances on cable back in the day, but it truly is one of those movies that, you know, when it is released, you know, everyone who has the nostalgic love for it will find it, and I would imagine that, you know, a new wave of kids will, you know, find it. And it sort of represents, you know, a type of filmmaking that has sort of gotten lost over the years. Frank and I have talked about how everything has gotten so intense and crazy and wild with kids' movies or teenage movies, and, you know, Rad is just one of those, you know, innocently fun type films that showcase something cool and exciting that, you know, you and your friends could talk about. But it was made in that great, you know, 1980s style.
Yeah, it was definitely hit with an 80s stick pretty hard. And, and, you know, I think a lot about cult fans and what attracts them to movies for years, throughout the years and decades, you know, and I just think that, you know, if you went to see Star Wars back in the day, which I did not, you know, it captured your imagination, but nobody had a Millennium Falcon in the garage. You know, you couldn't really play that out until you got a few degrees and hopefully got hired by NASA, but almost everybody had a bicycle in their garage. So once they saw that movie, they could immediately start playing out their dreams and ending up in the hospital and recuperating and doing it again and again and again until they get that trick that they're after. So that kind of dedication. You know, I heard Jerry Seinfeld say recently that when he sees a kid on a skateboard, he goes, you know what, that kid's going to be fine. He knows how to take a licking, get back up, and master something, you know. So I think there's a lot to be said for that. And people really took to that movie, went out and practiced the tricks, and it became a part of their life. So that's the impact, and that's the difference, I think, between that movie and a lot of others. And obviously not everybody went out and rode bikes because of it. You know, they the morality of the story and the, you know, unbelievable athleticism of the people they hired to be my stunt doubles and the writers in the movie just really hit a lot of notes for the audience.
Right. How did you first get involved with the project?
Just as a simple audition. The director had seen me on a TV show, Hill Street Blues, which was popular at the time. I had a nice featured role on that. And so he brought me in. I think he already had decided that he was going to cast me. You know, it was kind of my role to lose when I walked in the door, and I looked the part, and I looked 17 when I sat on that bicycle, and they liked what I did. So, you know, it was only a few weeks later that I was on a plane to Calgary. And so, you know, I did not have the time to prepare for the role that I would like, you know. So most of the writing was done by stunt writers. And fortunately, I could get on a bike and ride it in a fairly straight line and then just, you know, stick the hockey helmet on me and we're all places, you know.
Right. For sure. That film has such a great cast. You know, even I haven't seen it in a while. I should actually try and find the Laserdisc for it because I do have a Laserdisc player. But, I mean, Tally Shire, Ray Walston's always amazing. Mm-hmm. And I feel like he was more so iconic in the 80s films, I think partly due to Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I love him in that film.
He was great, and I understand that's why they hired him for the role, because of Fast Times, and he had that kind of niche audience going for him. And, of course, Jack Weston was in it.
So, right.
Yeah, I approached it from an actor's standpoint. That was my favorite part of working on Rad, or, you know, one of my favorite parts is actually getting to act with these stellar actors. That's what it's about, really, is being able to surround yourself with great players and just jump into the mix. It makes it fun and easy and awe-inspiring if you've grown up watching these actors like I had. So that was a tremendous part of it for me.
Right.
What was it like working with Hal Needham? And for people who, you know, may not know the name, Hal Needham's an old school stuntman. He directed movies like Smokey and the Bandit, Cannonball Run, became known for sort of like the stunt action film back in the day. What was it like working with him?
Well, he was truly one of the larger than life characters I've run into through the years. Before he was the famed action director, he was the highest paid stuntman in Hollywood. And so he had a whole big career before he started his enormous career in directing. And what that gives a person, these stunt guys who put their lives on the line, you know, for a paycheck, is kind of a devil-may-care attitude. They're hard living. A lot of them are, you know, hard drinking, fast driving, just balls out kind of individuals, you know. So he was from the South, wore a huge cowboy hat, the big belt buckle, and the crease in the jeans and the boots. I can just see it all right now. It was just, it was so bigger than what most people are used to, and I think that's how he carved out a career for himself. Obviously, he was very talented, but extremely charming and funny. Uneducated, he quit school after elementary school or something like that, not long after that, but a brilliant guy nonetheless, and that kind of redneck cornpone attitude, as we're now finding out, is a big section of our country. And he was into, he could tap into that, you know, and was never a critic's favorite, but made many, many hundreds of millions of dollars for the studios, just ignoring the critics and giving the people what they wanted. Fast cars, big jugs, and great stunts, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it really is incredible. You know, if you were to take a look at some of his credits, and I just queued it up because the name has long been known in my memory banks as someone who just was a huge player in the stunt world. But I mean, this guy worked on, I mean, it's like endless. It's like Little Big Man, Chinatown, the Mission Impossible television series, the Culpepper Cattle Country. White Lightning. I mean, it's the Longest Yard. It really is something else. You know, those type of credits. And when you watch a film, and again, I haven't seen Red in a real long time, and I really hope that it's true that it's going to come out and hit Blu-ray. It really was one of those movies for me, like the Monster Squad and Explorers, and you know, like as Frank said, the Ewok Adventures. There were these little sort of off-the-cuff movies that had a little bit more edge, there's a little bit something more different about them, and I really can't wait to see it again. But what always struck me is, it was so exciting, was that I was never, you know, I never had a chance to do bike tricks and stuff like that, so it was a totally foreign thing to me. But what I always loved about it was just how exotic the whole thing felt, and I can only imagine how it must have led to so many kids trying this out who never would have otherwise.
That's a fact. I've talked to thousands of athletes, and that is their ground zero for getting into the sport and taking them into, whether it's bicycle manufacturing, being professional athletes, bike store owners. It just got into people's blood. And in this economy and with the environment, it's a really important subject. So I love that my new movie, Heroes of Dirt, is kind of bringing BMX back to the movie screens, and I'm fortunate to be in that kind of position where I can talk about it and I have an audience.
Yeah, tell us about your new film. I'm very much looking forward to seeing this. I looked it up and it looks awesome.
Thanks. It's a good movie, and it was written and directed by Eric Bugbee. Also written by Kevin Bashore and Bob Massey and Jill Bugbee. So it's a modern tale of a young guy who is a BMX up-and-comer, and he uses that sport to help a street kid kind of get in out of the difficult situation he's been thrust into. So it's a little more street than Rad. There's a little more grit to it. It's probably a PG-13 rating, and that's good. You know, our audience has grown, and Rad was a very kind of Disney, although it wasn't a Disney film, it was kind of a Disney
right.
outlook on life and kind of a dreamy, like, utopia, where Heroes of Dirt is much more grounded in reality, and looking at these latchkey kids with parents who may not be doing the best job. And so the theme in Heroes of Dirt is mentorship and kind of overcoming life's obstacles and using BMX as kind of a metaphor, but an actual real-life event that these guys use to kind of overcome their shortcomings. And so in this one, I get to play the Talia Shire character. So I don't have the apron, but I got the attitude from her, and it's weird to see it come around like that, but I'm so excited to still be involved in the sport in that way. And Eric, the director, grew up watching Rad, so it was kind of a natural for him to reach out to me.
Right, I imagine that when he might have been putting this project together, you had to have been one of the first people he thought of when casting parts, or even bringing everything together. Because it's like, I got to get Bill Allen, because obviously this film has to be heavily inspired upon Rad.
Well, you'd have to talk to Eric about that. I understand he was interested in Bon Jovi for that role at one point, and he's like, no, we need to get Bill Allen. You know, for somebody who grew up on BMX, it's just, to have any sort of connection with that movie, I think, is pretty cool. So I was still in the game and went out there, and lo and behold, years later, here we are. It just opened. Really happy with it. The reviews are good. The BMX community is embracing it, so I'm really happy about that.
That's great. Tell us a little bit about your memoir that you just published.
Okay, I wrote a book called My Rad Career. My pushy wife, who's also a writer, told me I need to give the fans a book, so I did. I didn't really have enough for an entire book based on the Rad experiences, so that's a section of it and a big part of it, because it's a big part of my story, but it kind of encompasses most of my career up until a year or so ago when I wrote it. So a lot of crazy stories, a lot of cool personalities that you all know and love, and it's kind of I kind of take the gloves off and name some names and tell some tales and let people in on the journey, and not just the good parts, but the low points also, because those are equally as important.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to getting that. I'm definitely going to pick it up from your site. I can't wait to read it. So tell us a little bit about your journey from Rad to now, what you were doing,
Okay, well, I will try to encapsulate the last 30 years in 5 minutes. 5 minutes or less. But I continue to act after Rad, to do movies and TV whenever they would let me. I was not aware of kind of the growing cult around Rad after it came out. I just kind of let it go, and it was doing its own thing while I was off doing my own thing, which was, I was able to do some more television and movies, and also got into a band, a blues band with my good friend Lou Diamond Phillips. And so we did a lot of touring around the U.S. and Canada, and so that was pretty exciting. So that's a big part of my past. I was in New Mexico for a number of years, kind of hiding from the business, and yet living out in New Mexico, I found out there's a lot of acting work to be had, because there's a lot of series and TV shows that are shot out there. So in Albuquerque and Santa Fe, I ended up working more out there as an actor than I was back here in Los Angeles. So I tried to run away from it all and ended up back on a movie set. And, you know, so it seemed kind of divinely orchestrated. You know, I it's like I can't get away from it if I tried, and I don't try. I kind of like it.
How did the music thing come up with Lou Diamond Phillips?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story. I had a theater company with the late, great Brandon Lee and a director by the name of John Lee Hancock, who wrote and directed like The Blind Side and Saving Mr. Banks, etc. So we had a theater company together, and John wrote a play about a blues band starring my brother Sherman, and Brandon was in it, myself, and we put together a blues band for the play. It was a plot point in the play. And after the play closed, the band stayed together, and Lou was circling around. He knew all these players and fancied himself a singer, and he's actually a good singer. So he started jumping into rehearsals because we were rehearsing in his living room, so it was kind of easy. And yeah, it just kind of caught on from there. We started getting great gigs and doing soundtracks and touring with people like Billy Ray Cyrus, who was as big as Miley back in the day. And we just had a great time. So we continue to do movies together. He's directed a lot. I've been able to work with him a lot in that capacity. And then most recently on the music front, he sang on a CD that I produced called The King of Clubs. A mutual friend of ours, Bugs Henderson, who was a Texas blues kind of luminary, genius guitar player, passed away a couple of years ago. So I executive produced a CD of some of his songs that he wrote or performed. And Lou sang on it. Steve Lukather from Toto is on it. Vivian Campbell from, what is it, Poison and Whitesnake's on it. And Orianthe, the blonde from Michael Jackson's band. So I've got a lot of cool, like, you know, celebrity names on it and fantastic studio musicians. It's a 2-CD set, and it's probably the coolest thing I've done in my career.
Wow, that sounds amazing.
It is amazing. Yeah, I'm really proud of it. And
that's awesome.
So yeah, it's called The King of Clubs. You can get it on CD Baby or Amazon, and it's a tribute to the music of Bugs Henderson. I'm very proud of it.
Awesome. I'm definitely going to have to check that out. That sounds great.
It's great. Thank you.
You had mentioned that you were living for a while in New Mexico, which offered you a chance to get the opportunity to work on some projects that are getting shot out of New Mexico, which, you know, like as you said, TV and film are constantly going there for a variety of reasons. And I'm just when you look at your credits, you've got some really eclectic things on there between television and movie. And I'm just wondering, was The Astronaut Farmer? I know it was a small part, but was that something that was one of those New Mexico projects that you got cast in? Because, so underrated. And I remember seeing it in the theater and just being like, wow, like this place should be packed, and every family should be going to check this movie out. This is a great family movie. So it's really cool that you were a part of that film. How did that come about?
I just auditioned for it and got the role. And, you know, a lot of these things you go into and you go, well, it's not a great role, you know. Whatever. And then all of a sudden you're hanging with Billy Bob Thornton or Renee Zellweger or Jake Gyllenhaal or Tobey Maguire, and you go, you know what, this doesn't suck. You know, this is the room I've been trying to get in my whole life. So those are the moments that kind of make it all worth it. And my moment on that set was getting to talk with Billy Bob Thornton and getting to watch him work up close. He's better than you imagine he is. He's one of our true great film actors, bar none. He's just one of the greats. And to watch that happen off camera, it's a masterclass. And somebody who approaches the work in kind of a different way than I'm used to working, it was mind-bending. And I got to talk to him, and he did a kind favor for me. So I just cannot say enough good things about Billy Bob Thornton. I love that man. I love that man.
Big fan of his work always. It's actually funny. Over last weekend, I was rewatching some of Friday Night Lights, and I just love his performance there. He's so good. And it's like you've seen so many sports movies before, and The Coach and The Speech and The Big Game, and he like underplayed it perfectly. And he's always, like you said, he's just always so good with really whatever he does. And but it's just so great because The Astronaut Farmer is one of those movies, again, that just – because every year there's a handful of films that just kind of sneak by audiences. They, you know, they've got a weird title or different, you know, a strange poster, or the trailer doesn't really accurately convey what the movie is sort of presenting. And for me, that's definitely in that vein of a movie that really deserves to be discovered.
We get caught up in we get caught up a lot in box office. That was never the thing back in the golden era of movies. People didn't care what the box office was. They just didn't know, and it wasn't a part of the conversation. And did you see the movie? Yeah. Did you like the movie? Great. You know, that's all that matters. I mean, if we going back to Rad, it was a bomb at the box office, but it found its audience, obviously, and that's what matters. We're all going to be dead and gone in 100 years, you know, so what is going to live on are these movies, and nobody's going to care what the opening weekend box office was.
Absolutely.
It's time and the audience that determine what movies are going to stick around. You know, a lot of these movies may have $300 million opening weekends, and then you forget. Who's going to be talking about the Transformers in 20 years? Nobody.
I mean, I couldn't agree more. And when Nick and I started our podcast, I mean, we essentially built it on the foundation of films like you just described, like films that were either critical or commercial failures that we think are just, we absolutely love, and we think that people need to, like, you know, revisit these movies or seek them out for the first time. And I think we've been pretty successful with that because that's kind of been our focus with our podcast. And that's why it was so incredible to have, you know, I think a film like Red is a perfect example of the films that we like now that probably, I don't know if it'll get to where Red is, you know, 20, 30 years from now, but you know, Rad's a prime example of what you were just speaking about, where, you know, no one's going to care about Transformers in however many years, because it's just one of those huge action films that make a ton of money that everybody forgets about and stuff like that. It's the smaller films that have so much heart and have something to say that have the staying power.
Well, let's go back to a couple of flops of their day, Citizen Kane or It's a Wonderful Life. They died at the box office early,
right?
You know, and so does that affect what they are? No, they're the greatest movies ever made. So, like I said, good filmmakers get knocked down because they don't have $100 million opening weekend. When back in the golden days of Hollywood, the studios would finance big budgeted films that they knew would make no money because they knew it was the right thing to do. They knew that they were artists, and at the end of the day, they had to live with themselves on a certain level that at least they've done some things that kind of raised the bar and raised the conversation. Yeah, they had to make their money, and they had to put out the bad, you know, kind of B-movies also, but there was an understanding of, hey, we can really affect the conversation, and we are artists, so let's pay attention to that. You know, MGM, the phrase at the top of it means art for art's sake. Well, you never hear that phrase anymore. That's a joke.
No, not too often. What it feels very obvious to me, and I'm sure to Frank, that you're a passionate movie buff in general. What are some of your favorite movies, you know, outside of the stuff that you've had a chance to work on? You know, like if you were to sit down, what would be something that you'd very easily likely put on?
Oh, man, there's too many, and there's too many good ones coming out all the time. And I was a big fan of Birdman last year, and obviously independent films are the future for feature films outside of the studio blockbuster. So, you know, I'm a big Robert Altman fan. I'm a big John Cassavetes fan. I love the writer-director auteurs. I used to be a Woody Allen fan. I can't admit that in public anymore because of his proclivities. But the real true writer directors who can bring their singular vision to the screen, you know, those filmmakers I mentioned made at least a dozen or so films that are in the great American film library, you know. So if you're not familiar with those filmmakers, look them up. But what they represent is kind of the vanguard of independent film. And now with digital media, and now it's so cheap to do your own movies, it's a real exciting time to be an artist in that medium.
One of my favorite sets I own is the Criterion Collection put out the John Cassavetes 5-film set, Shadows, Faces, Woman Under the Influence, Killing of a Chinese Bookie, Opening Night, love those films. I haven't gotten the Blu-ray upgrade yet. I'm sure I will at some point. I probably in their November sale, but Woman Under the Influence, I just recently watched that, and every time I watch that film, I'm just completely blown away by the rawness of that film and the way Cassavetes captures everything. It's as if he's just capturing real life, and it's not this, you know, gigantic, polished film with, like, crane shots, which is awesome, too. I mean, I love that stuff. That's why I love Brian De Palma, is for, like, the sweeping camera movements and everything like that. But, yeah, I mean, Cassavetes is just, that's a recurring theme with a lot of filmmakers and actors and everybody we have on here, is John Cassavetes gets name-dropped quite a bit, and rightfully so.
Well, yeah, he's really the godfather to a lot of these independent filmmaking artists, so... What separates him from the guys who really made it big, the Woody Allens, the, you know, is he was up against the wall financially the whole time. He was mortgaging his house to make these movies. You know, I mean, he knew he was on a time clock, and he wasn't getting the studio financing he needed, so he went out and did it. And this was all film. There was no digital media back in the day. They had to pay for developing and film prints and all that stuff. So. Yeah, he's one of the cats you have to look at, and I think it's really important to know your film history. I just do. Call me crazy. If you're going to be in the arts, if you're going to be a film person, yeah, you should study these guys.
Yeah, I know Nick is a huge Cassavetes fan as well, and we're both huge Woody Allen fans, and Altman as well. I thought it was cool you dropped Birdman, because... Birdman, I was obsessed with when that came out last year.
No. I was going to say, I love Birdman as well. It took chances at a studio level that you normally don't get a chance to see taken by, you know, quote unquote, the money, you know, the money people. The themes of that movie are typically reserved for the independent movies and the smaller things and the outside, you know, the outside finance type project. So it's good to hear that you're a fan of that one, because I know I loved it.
Plus, it brought Michael Keaton back. And everybody loves Michael Keaton.
He was amazing. I thought he got robbed.
Yeah, I did too. I can't even... I'm still mad about it when I think back to it. But I mean, I have a strong suspicion that the Academy is going to give him an award for Spotlight this year, even though I haven't seen the film. But it's getting a lot of great press, and I can't wait to see that. So...
just kind of points up the absurdity of competition in the arts, and the Academy.
Yeah.
The Academy almost always gets it wrong, and it's a bunch of old farts, and who cares? Well, you know, I mean, it promotes the industry, and it's a commercial for the industry, but to pit artist against artist and to say that one performance is better than the other, I just did it, and it's not really cool, and it's not fair. Eddie Redmayne is probably a great guy. He obviously did a great job. You know, who am I to say Michael Keaton was better than him? Just shut up. Just invite everybody to the party, and we're all winners. But we got to have winners in this country,
right?
You know. Anyway,
and just sort of wanted to circle back a little bit too. Like when you first got involved with Rad, you casting, and you went and you met, and they, you know, you felt like they were. You know, that they liked you up front. What was it that sort of inspired you to go and check out that process at that age that you were at? And, you know, what led you to, you know, finding Rad?
There might have been other people on his radar. I really don't know. Chad Lowe. But anyway, I was cast when I was 19 in a film out of Dallas where I grew up, about a jockey. So I got the lead role in this. It starred Jose Ferrer. Are we familiar with Jose, Frank?
Yeah.
Okay, the great Jose Ferrer. And his sons were brought along to be in the movie. Miguel, who's now on NCIS Los Angeles, I think, and his brother. So they were brought onto this lengthy shoot, like Apocalypse Now. It was just never ending. And their cousin George came down from Cincinnati. And it turns out his last name was Clooney. You might have heard of it. So Clooney comes down and visits us on the set and becomes a part of the clique and actually gets a role in the movie and spends time with his cousins probably for the first time in his life. And that was George and my first intro into movies, actually. He'd kind of grown up around show business. So we were on that movie for 6 months, then both went back to our respective corners, me to Dallas, he to Cincinnati, and then we both ended up out in Los Angeles for the first time, right at the same time. We had the same agent. We both stayed at Rosemary Clooney's guest house for a time being. So it was through that movie in Kentucky that I was able to get an acting mentor, Brian O'Byrne. I got my SAG card. I got a few $1,000 in the bank. And how are you going to keep them on the farm after they've seen Perry, man? Once I saw Los Angeles for the first time, I'm like, well, I can't really go back to Dallas anymore. You know, I've been in Dealey Plaza several times. There's not much else to see there. So, yeah, I ended up in Los Angeles in probably 1983 after one of the guy who played my father in the jockey movie, the horse racing movie, was an actor by the name of Adam Rourke. Does this ring a bell? He was in Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry. Look him up. He was.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he was in a lot of, like, the old bikers movies in the 60s and a really cool, great character actor. Well, after the movie in Kentucky, he moved to Dallas and started a film acting class, and a really well-respected and very good film acting class. I was probably the first student there. My brother was part of it. And that's where we met a young Lou Diamond Phillips. He was fresh out of UT at the time. And he was one of the very early students at Adam's class. So it was in that atmosphere after and thereof that I kind of learned to act in front of a camera and be comfortable in front of a camera. And within a year or so, I moved out to Los Angeles and started working pretty quickly. Like I said, I had an agent when I came out here and some money and a SAG card. So I was not just arriving at the Greyhound station with nothing. And so... yeah, I used to see George a lot back in those days. He's done pretty well for himself, so I haven't seen him in some time. But that was kind of my run-up to Rad, was that jockey movie, and it never came out, and the producer got sent to jail. I mean, it was a whole thing. But when you're 19 years old and this is your whole life, you go, well, my world is caved in. And I eventually saw the movie. It was the worst movie. It was worse than The Room. You know, it's just... It was heinous, you know, so I'm so glad that it didn't come out, and it allowed me to come out here. So all things worked out for a reason, I suppose.
Yeah, for sure.
But that was George Clooney's first movie, was And They're All.
Wow.
Yeah.
This has been a fantastic chat, seriously. I still can't even believe I got a chance to speak with you. This has been great. And before we sign off, we always invite people, if you ever want to come back, talk about any movie. Doesn't even have to be a movie you've been in, one of your favorite movies, some movie that you think's underseen and should be seen. You're more than welcome to. You have an open invitation anytime. So we really appreciate your time, man. This has been fantastic.
Thanks, Frank, Nick. I had a good time, guys.
Yeah, it was great. It was great meeting you.
You too.
Absolutely. Nice to meet you over the Skype, and thanks a lot for coming on the show, and I will definitely be looking out for any information on an upcoming release for Rad on Blu-ray or DVD. So it's long overdue, and I would imagine with the 30th anniversary around the corner, hopefully they, you know, somebody gets off their butts and gets a commentary done or some sort of, you know, a new, you know, behind the scenes featurette, because I can only imagine that you guys would be able to share.
Well, I'll keep my fingers crossed for you. And I should mention that we actually did a commentary reel that is on iTunes. It's called Rad Behind the Scenes, and you sync it up with your own copy of Rad, and we've got a pretty good commentary reel.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, check that out. It's on iTunes. Rad.
Certainly will.
Behind the Scenes, Rad.
That's great. Yeah, great to know.
Put a link for that up as well. That's awesome.
Definitely. For anyone who does have a copy of Rad, check that out at iTunes if you ever wanted to hear the real people behind it talk, you know. I always like to say somewhere there's like a triple bill with Rad and the Dirt Bike Kid and Gleaming the Cube playing. These were like all these three movies when I was a kid I used to be obsessed with. They all came out around the same time. So yeah. I'm not sure if you're familiar with those other two ones, those, you know, those sort of like cultish items.
You bet. Yeah, somewhere in heaven there's a triple feature going on.
Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, Bill. This was great.
Thanks.
Thank you.